All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are yet again talking more Survivor 41. Dominic, episode 10, what a week. How are you feeling?
I still don't know. We put this off for a few days, and I thought that might give me time to process my thoughts about this episode and figure out exactly what my feelings are about the season, and hasn't helped at all. So hopefully just coming in here and doing it live will help to finally bring all of that together.
That is a technique I have used many times over the years with varying degrees of success there. But I guess let me ask you this. Obviously, an enormous development that we just saw go down Wednesday night, now losing Shan, spoiler alert, for anyone who has not seen it yet, the person who, as far as I had been concerned, basically from the premiere, appeared to be just the main character of this season. What was watching that in real time like for you? How, scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you?
I was stunned, and they did a good job of hooking me in with the usual decoy boot setup, and I thought this was one of those episodes where they go through the motions and they make us think it's going to be something else. We might actually get the plan that people always talk about and never follow through on, but then we're going to get some like split vote between Erica and Heather or something, just the most predictable, frustrating, unnecessary outcome that you could possibly imagine. And that's what I had steeled myself for. And I was ready to come in here and be a little just disillusioned by the episode of just being so transparent about taking us on that failed wild goose chase, except the goose is dead. The goose is well and truly cooked now, and I'm still not quite sure what happened.
As I was watching this in real time, was like tilted about the fact that they were using Shan as the decoy boot. Say, like, obviously Shan is never going to be the one who gets eliminated here. What are we doing? Let's just not use this as some sort of storytelling technique, and was just about as blindsided by a vote result as I can ever remember being. The one that came to mind immediately for me, I've told this story, I'm sure, a couple of times over the years on the podcast, but I'll quickly retell it. During the Cagayan finale, after Wu won that final immunity challenge, I was watching the episode with a friend of mine who was over, and he was a casual Survivor fan as well. And at that point, it seemed like such a foregone conclusion that Wu was obviously going to vote out Tony and demolish Cass in Final Tribal Council that we were like barely paying attention anymore. And he was off like setting up the backgammon board so we could just skip watching Final Tribal Council and get back to degenerate gambling. And I was like, just let me make 100% sure that it is, in fact, Tony being eliminated here. And I was astounded when that happened. And that's the only other thing that I can think of, at least that immediately came to mind, of like this level of shock for me result.
Did casual Greg or whoever he is, did he appreciate the gravity of that moment?
Far less, it appears, than I think he, frankly, incidentally, Greg, good guess, but way off. I think he, even after the gravity of that moment sunk in, still would have rather just skipped ahead to the backgammon. But either way here, Dom, yeah, an absolutely monumental episode, not just for this season, but as far as I'm concerned, for like, and this may be slightly overstating it, but I'm going to put it out there anyway. The entire course of Survivor history.
God.
So normally we save the super specific kind of edit discussion for the edit zone at the end of the episode, because it is certainly not everyone's favorite thing about the general kind of online Survivor discussion. And in, I think, literally every single edit zone of the season to this point, a lot of that discussion was focused around Shan. This week, I feel like I can pretty confidently say I have never, since we began doing this podcast over a decade ago at this point, been less clear on what the hell to expect going forward for a season. And I think in this specific case, it would be worthwhile to just put a kind of blanket edit zone disclaimer that we're not going to be going hard in the paint with the edit discussion necessarily the whole time, but I do think this is an exception where that sort of thing is one of the primary things that I do want to get into, just because I feel like Shan and her role on this season combined with her ultimate result here have gone a long, long way in making me just rethink everything I ever thought I knew about what the Survivor edit looks like. And that itself, I think, is an interesting and worthwhile conversation to have in the main portion.
Yeah. Let's get into that then, because for me, I don't think it's a good thing when someone is so front and center in a season that you really can't imagine the rest of the season without them. And they seem to be the only plausible contender, whether it's from an edit perspective or a game logic perspective. And with that person off the board, it's just impossible to see how everything scrambles. It can be fun in the short term, but I think that you don't want to get yourself in a habit of, we have so underdeveloped the rest of the cast that this one big, amazing blindside just leaves the next few episodes just kind of stumbling to pick up the pieces. I don't think that's fully what they've done here. I do think we have a good idea of maybe who could take that ball and run with it now. But let's get into just the whole edit zone of it all here in a fairly abridged form.
Yes. So the reason that I say this to me is like a monumental episode that, at least as far as I'm personally concerned, and I don't know if the rest of the Survivor internet is necessarily on the same page here, but going forward now, I am going to have a much, much harder time being confident in pretty much anyone, almost no matter how visible they are over the course of a given season in this new era, where I was in recent weeks opening my mind more to the possibility that this could be a season about how Shan lost rather than how Shan won. But in either of those cases, I thought she was essentially a lock to be in there, not only even necessarily through the finale, but probably at Final Tribal Council. This time last week, if you had asked me, I would have given obscene odds on Shan being at Final Tribal Council. And now going forward, to have this example to point back to in my mind of, yes, this person on some future hypothetical season could be getting glowing winner treatment or like obvious main character treatment, or they could just be the next Shan. And that is something that I have wanted for a long, long time. And a few days ago was Thanksgiving here in America, Dom. And this is genuinely one of the things that I am most thankful for in the history of Survivor, is Shan getting this big of an edit despite not even making it to Final Seven. I think this is a complete game changer as far as reading the Survivor edit goes.
So I think I'm both more optimistic and more pessimistic on that front than you are in different ways. So I think that Shan's edit is special because for the first however many episodes, it was actively one of the strongest edits that we'd ever seen. And then by the time it started to have this dramatic reversal where Shan was almost getting drunk on power and she was being called out by her allies left and right, and it felt like some part of that foundation was starting to crumble. At that point, if you had said to me, hey, I don't think Shan's edit looks so good anymore, I would have agreed with you. But then the question immediately becomes, well, who else is there? And I said as recently as last week before Evie got eliminated, hey, I mean, Evie still has a fantastic edit. I think that it should be Shan and Evie number one, number two. And then once Evie left, I thought, okay, now it's time to lock in Shan and just accept that as the reality. And so I think there's a difference between this person in a generally well-rounded cast or well-rounded edit is putting in such a good performance that how could it possibly be anyone else, versus we have literally seen so little from the rest of the cast, or what we have seen is very ambiguous or uncertain, that it's not just this person has a good edit, this person has the default edit. And that's kind of the two halves of the equation that Shan was trying to balance towards the end. If you contrast that with to go back to the season that made us eventually sequester the edit zone in the first place in Koh Rong, we locked in Michelle, what was it, episode 4 or thereabouts, And to us, that was a completely bulletproof bulletproof call in a cast where other people did have big edits. You know, Aubrey was a really massive character in that season. You had Scott and Jason over here. You had Ty over here. You had other stuff going on. But beneath all of that, it was very clear, like, this is Michelle's to lose, and it's hard to see how that's even possible. Versus this time around, where it feels like it might be the story of how Shan lost, but God knows who she loses to, because no one else seems to be in the mix anymore.
Right, but I think the fact that we had Shan and Evie as, like, the runaway top two contenders, certainly after the premiere, and in the bulk of the pre-merge, before, I just was totally locked in on Shan as singularly the one to keep an eye on. The fact that, as far as I'm concerned, both of the, like, big time pre-merge standouts are now gone with seven people left in the game, and I don't think we have anyone that we can reliably fall back on and say, okay, well, now this person becomes the obvious front runner once Shan and Evie are out of the picture, that is beyond refreshing and quite,
love it. Yeah.
Might honestly be the literal number one sort of thing that I would have wanted to see out of the new era of Survivor, is a deviation in how they present people who are huge characters and could easily warrant a ton of screen time, but just don't go deep enough into the game to, in years past, as far as it seems like the editors or producers or whoever's making these sorts of calls were concerned, to actually get that kind of screen time. I love that they are, at long last, willing to go that far, and furthermore, willing to have faith in the audience to, one, handle that sort of short-term heartbreak, and two, follow along with whatever happens after those people leave. Like, I don't know who it's going to be, but I'm very confident that by the time we hit finale night, the average casual fan is going to be totally fine with whoever it ultimately ends up being, whoever it ultimately ends up being that is our eventual winner here. And that is a hill I have been dying on for a long time. And the number one thing I always want on Survivor, or just on TV in general, and this is, say it with me, Dom, why I love The Genius, is a show that is willing to just do it to me. Like, the best case scenario for any given Wednesday night, as far as I'm concerned, is for me to be totally wrong as far as my expectations versus what actually comes in. And I do not remember a time that we have ever come in here to cover any of the seasons that we've done over a very large sample at this point where I've been more optimistic along those lines about the future.
Yeah, I think that as we get towards the end game as well, we have, what, seven people left now? And it's quite rare that with that few people left, you have more than two or maybe three people who you think are still in contention to take it down, whether it's edit-wise, game-wise, whatever. And I can't do this off the top of my head, but if I look back over the past 10 seasons, let's say, and analyze how many people I thought were in with a serious chance that late in the game, it's usually a pretty narrow pool. So the fact that I still think a few people are kind of out of it, like, I don't think the big Heather reveal is coming, you know, 54 minutes into the finale, sorry to say. But for the most part, yeah, I think the rest of them are in with a chance. And I'm not ruling people out the way that maybe I would have before, because I think increasingly there's a kind of a late game recency bias in play where, as long as you finish strong, if you have a good last few episodes, or in the case of Chris Underwood, a good final episode, that basically makes up for the sins of the past 13 weeks. And so, you know, right now, I don't think anyone's talking about Danny as a serious winner contender, right? But if Danny comes in here next week and he has a few more confessionals than he's had in the past, and he starts winning a few challenges in a row, and he finishes strong going into the finale, I think that the average viewer, if he wins, we'll look back at that and they're not going to be complaining about, well, in episode 5, he didn't have that many confessionals. I think that's
right.
A frame that we impose on it to, you know, because we're doing this week by week with this amount of effort put in. And so in the wake of Shan's untimely departure, there's a lot of, well, maybe it's Erica now, or maybe it's, you know, just reaching around for whichever names are left on the board. And I think that you can make a theory for each of them, and that's fine, because, again, it's not a theory based on what's happened so far, which kind of doesn't matter. It's a theory based on the, you know, I guess the week or two that we have left.
Right, and that's, I mean, something we've talked about and probably been very annoying about for a long time at this point, is I have always been a huge believer that giving people the, like, glowing winner edit from pillar to post is totally unnecessary as far as the casual audience is concerned, and largely just serves to tip it to the people who are looking at the edit and make it less suspenseful for them, which is, like, I think the opposite of what a lot of those folks, and I include myself in that group, want there. Dom, while Shan obviously played an enormous role in the first 10 episodes of this season, I was racking my brain trying to come up with others from the course of Survivor history who've been, like, this visible without going super deep into the game. And to be honest, I didn't know if anyone would even be, like, in the conversation with Shan. However, I reached out to at Rob's Fact Checker on Twitter to see if they had some numbers on this, and it turns out that Shan is, let me see here, the 11th, if you can believe it, most visible person who, and hopefully I am able to frame this correctly, the specifications that I asked for were people who made the merge but did not make Final Seven. So, any guesses of names that might have actually, by whatever metric Rob's Fact Checker is using, were more over-edited than Shan, who made the merge but did not make Final Seven? Because there are, I had this filtered out because a lot of the, like, super early boots, like a Francesca, for instance, will get, like, 13 confessionals in the one right episode they're in, but large-ish kind of sample size for a season of Survivor, but not making it to Final Seven. Any guesses from you?
So I think I'm looking at a bunch of merge boots or early post-merge boots who were, like, the big figure in the minority alliance, and maybe it's on a returning player season, maybe it's a fan favorite who gets clipped pretty quick there. So I'm going to say, like, Karamur and Malcolm, maybe?
I will say that is exactly what you were looking at for the most part, although Malcolm not on the list here.
Okay, I'll see, perhaps.
Another interesting guess, although also not on the list. I will say the top two people on this list, and this is going to be a huge hint to you, although I'm not sure how much it's going to help any audience members playing at home, both former podcast guests on this very network.
Oh, God. I think that's actually something more, as much as that might be to believe.
But yeah,
South Pacific Cochrane, of course, although is that under the Final Seven?
Yes, he is technically on this list counted as the 8th place finisher, and he is number one.
Yeah, I think that's an odd place to cut it off. I think, like, finale episode, Final Three or whatever, maybe it's more natural for working it out. But I see what you're getting at here. Who are the other names who were in that conversation?
Okay, so number one is Cochrane on South Pacific. If you can believe it, numbers two and three, both from the same season. Coming in, and it is one of the last seasons, I'm guessing a lot of people would guess, coming in at number two, how about Marty Piombo, who I don't think I would have immediately guessed, if ever guessed, but in retrospect, once I saw his name on there, I do remember him getting a huge amount of visibility while he was in there. And then Nyanka, also from that same season, in here at number three. Number four.
Hey, I would have thought Brenda from that season too, honestly.
Not a bad call, although not ultimately on the list here. I will say, when I was trying to brainstorm people that I thought might be above Shan, the one name that I came up with was Rupert in Pearl Islands, and he is on this list. He's at number eight, but ahead of even Rupert, we have Kelly Kim from Island of the Idols, Jeremy from San Juan del Sur. How about this one? This one I legit laughed out loud. Our number six most over-edited person who made the merge but did not make Final Seven. How about Troyzan in One World, who would then later go on to be, I got this stat as well, Troyzan in Game Changers, the number 43 most under-edited person of all time. And then a truly iconic run here as we have in the number seven spot, Andrew Savage in Pearl Islands, number eight, Rupert in Pearl Islands, number nine, Jerry Manthey in Australia, and then number 10, the final person who is above Shan in being over edited along these lines. How about Andrew Savage again in Cambodia? He's on the list twice ahead of Shan.
Amazing.
Yeah. So shout out one more time at Rob's Fact Checker for pulling the data there. But yeah, I to return to just kind of the larger point here, while I may now be kind of like overcorrecting on future seasons and actively talking myself out of people being big time winner candidates because I'm concerned about being burned by a Shan type again in the future, that is exactly what I want. And I am fittingly on Thanksgiving week here, incredibly grateful that we got this sort of development, not at all because I dislike Shan or was rooting against Shan. I just love that this is on the table from a Survivor storytelling perspective when it seemed like it very much was not in years past.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's dive in now, Dom, to how all of this ended up going down. And I think a compelling case can be made that it all kind of kicked off at this reward challenge. Obviously, we had seen plenty of wheels in motion prior to this episode with some of Shan's closest allies in the entire game not necessarily loving the way that they were being treated within the alliance, or however you want to frame that. But as far as this sequence of events is concerned, I believe a case can be made that this all kind of spawned from there being an individual reward challenge where the winner had to pick people rather than a team reward challenge where people grab a rock out of a bag and whoever you're with is who you're with. When we see Ricard win this individual challenge and then pick Shan, Heather, and Xander to join him for pizza or whatever it was. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what the reward itself actually was. Right here is where we see the dialogue beginning about particularly Danny, it seems like, being nervous about what kind of long-term threat Ricard might be. And he and Deshaun try to pull in Liana and say, this may be one of the last opportunities we ever have to get rid of Ricard before he's close enough to the end to conceivably run the table or flip people or whatever the case may be. But Ricard certainly starting to pop up on a lot more people's radars than it seemed like we had at least heard about to this point. And not only is this idea going to be a Ricard blindside, but this is also going to be essentially a Shan blindside, because we, Danny, Deshaun, and Liana, are nervous about the prospect of telling Shan about this. So then when Liana decides to go spill those beans to Shan, who then re-spills the beans to Ricard, whose reaction we will get into. But I really feel like all of this can be traced back to there being an individual reward challenge rather than a team reward challenge.
I would be very skeptical about that, because
shouldn't be, because it's airtight and we should all just accept it as reality.
When that idea came up as the explanation for all of this, I was just groaning inside and possibly a little out loud too, because this is the same nonsense that we get fed every single time as the simple explanation for why someone ended up going home. It's, oh, they made a dodgy pick on a reward challenge, and that one thing was enough to turn the tables against them, or this is also what we get fed as the setup for a decoy boot in an episode where the actual boot is straightforward and they just need something, anything else to keep us looking and downing it for the next 30 minutes. And so I thought this was really going nowhere. And even knowing that it in fact went to the best place imaginable, I'm still scared because that's why this all happened. I don't think you make a move of that magnitude and that sets this whole train of events in motion if you haven't already been strongly considering that for some time now. And maybe this is a subtle effect of this shortened schedule where you don't have those lazy off days where you're kind of getting cabin fever and nothing's happening and you're itching to make a move and there's nothing to do. So you spend all your time on the beach, just like running through ideas and getting paranoid and downing yourself. And maybe it goes the other way where it's like, because the game is so fast paced, the moment an idea just like materializes, you grab onto it and hold it for everything you can, because who knows where the game's going next instead. But either way, yeah, I don't think this is because, oh, Ricard shorted fuck up by choosing these people instead of these people. I really don't think that's part of it.
And I don't mean that he necessarily was like so obvious about his jury management with who he ended up selecting there that is what suddenly put his name on the radar. I absolutely grant that this doesn't just happen out of thin air, and he was probably already someone that Danny and Deshaun in particular were potentially even just counting down the days until they had a good reason to come for Ricard. It is, I suppose, within the realm of possibility here, Dominic, that I'm just seeing what I really want to see as far as all of that is concerned. But I don't know. That doesn't really sound like me, especially not on this season there. But did want to get into when Shan tells Ricard, hey, Danny and Deshaun are coming for you. They tried to recruit Liana, but I don't want to see that happen. Ricard's reaction is really interesting to me, where instead of saying, oh my God, thank you so much for telling me, let's do whatever we can to turn this around, he says, I appreciate, he says, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, but it comes across as like, thanks for the heads up, but I'm surprised you would tell me that, because we're going to have to fight it out against one another someday, and you're kind of giving up a very clean opportunity, potentially, to take me out here if I don't win this necklace. More on that shortly, but it ties in.
If Ricard doesn't win that necklace, do you think this is essentially Shan giving him a heads up of, when you don't win, or if you don't win, then I'm probably going to have to go through with this plan to vote you out, and this is just a courtesy to you. This is a heads up more than anything else. And so, you know, when you eventually learn that they're taking the shot at you, you can't be mad at me because, hey, I told you, I let you, you know, I gave you the head start to fight back whoever you could, but there's nothing you can do because we have the numbers and that's just how it's going to be.
From what I have seen out of Shan this season, I would lean towards the side of, if she hears the name Ricard floating around and she doesn't want Ricard to be the person being eliminated, she's going to do what she can to make that not happen. So I think she genuinely was at this point telling Ricard so that he would be aware and they could form some sort of like counter maneuver to prevent that from happening in the timelines where he doesn't win the necklace that he obviously will go on to win. But the idea on his end of just saying to her face, I'm surprised you would tell me, you know, we're going to have to fight it out someday. And incidentally, when they were doing the reward together, they were talking openly at around the dinner table or whatever, whatever it was, about the fact that, like, I know I don't want to sit in the end with you. And it was both of them saying it to each other. And I thought Ricard had a really interesting confessional the first time around that we saw this come up, where he said, again, paraphrasing, Shan and I have enough love and respect for each other that we're open about the fact that, hey, we're going to have to fight it out someday. And that is something that I know probably caught a lot of people off guard. And I saw plenty of tweets wondering what the hell either of them was thinking, saying things along those lines to the person who was supposed to be their number one ally. But this is something that we have certainly seen in the past and discussed in great detail in the past. And the two big examples that stand out to me are when we saw this sort of thing from the Adam and David Wright duo in Millennials versus Gen X, and then again out of Wendell and Dom in Ghost Island. And both of those pairs ended up essentially monopolizing all of the winner equity by the time the end game rolled around. And I will once again say, now that we're seeing it in this new era, I think we're going to continue to see more of this. And I really want to hammer the point that Ricard made himself, that they're doing this because they respect each other. And the way to lose the trust of someone that you really do want to work with up until the very end of the game is by floating them this bullshit story that, oh, I can't wait to sit and go against you in Final Tribal Council, when they're never going to believe it. I think the underlying principle here is, I give Shan or I give Ricard enough intellectual credit to know that I would not want to sit next to them in the end. And I love seeing this sort of thing and continue to believe that as the show keeps casting more and more super fans who've gotten to see more and more seasons, and in essence, the average Survivor contestant becomes just better at Survivor, I think we're going to just continue to see more things along these lines.
You do have to be careful that the other person is on the same page with you and is making that assumption. So Stephen, I know, credits part of his downfall in Cambodia to the fact that he tried to be open in that way with Spencer, essentially saying, like, you know that I know that I can't take you to the end. But it seemed like Spencer did not know that. And Stephen saying that was enough to spook Spencer into, like, thinking about the assumptions he was making in the game and whether it was worth making some big play himself to overturn all of that. So can't take all of that for granted. But yeah, with the relationship that we've seen Ricard and Shan have, it's almost more suspicious to say, yeah, I'll gladly go with you to the end, especially for Ricard, more so than Shan. Whereas if you can get Shan to believe that, yes, eventually he will turn on me, but he doesn't think this is the right time, and I have a vote or two to get my ducks in order before that happens, then that both paints Ricard himself in a less threatening light and also maybe lulls you into a false sense of security, where if I know that the move is coming down the line, I need to keep my idol now for when that happens to make that harder. And so that kind of lowers your defenses for the one moment now, where if Ricard goes for that preemptive strike, is more likely to work.
Yeah, and we talked incidentally about this sort of like honesty to the point that the person you're talking to may be sketched out by it, if they're thinking about it on a different level than you would like for them to be thinking about it, as things pertain to Xander a couple of times in the early game. So he could be another compelling candidate to be having conversations along these lines this very season going forward. But yeah, I'm certainly eager to acknowledge that it is a potentially very high risk kind of line to take. But I think when executed well, it can be the most effective kind of narrative to be spinning to the people that you genuinely do want to work with for the long haul, but are not necessarily interested in sitting with at the end. And furthermore, this relatively new era of having at least the expectation of a fire-making challenge at Final Four, and at least the expectation that idols or random advantages we don't even know about are liable to just fall out of the sky pretty much any time unannounced, I think actually adds some value to taking this sort of approach. Like a scene that I vividly remember and was like horrified by in the moment, but I think it's a good illustration of kind of just the modern endgame dynamics, that was on, I guess it was Edge of Extinction, was Rick Devens and Chris Underwood finding themselves at Final Five where, like, one of them had an idol and one of them had a necklace, or they both had idols, or so whatever the case was, they both were, like, lock immune at Final Five. And Rick said to Chris, well, hey, at this point, we couldn't turn on each other even if we wanted to. And that's, like, a crazy thing to consider, as far as I'm concerned, from, like, a game purity sort of perspective. But it is just the modern reality. And I think that actually makes it a lot more compelling to take this sort of, like, brutally honest line with your allies, where you both go in understanding the end game is not going to come down to one of us wins final immunity and has to either take this person with us or vote them out in third place. The end game is a situation where it's pretty much every person for themselves, and there are going to be various different ways to get there. And when that time comes, our expectations are going to be where they should be. And that, I think, does add a lot of value to this sort of approach.
But on that subject, it's well worth noting that even though I'm sure some of this is informed, you know, having to make this move now versus later is informed by what if there is some hidden advantage that we don't know about or some twist coming down which could disrupt our best laid plans. But think about how little of the talk in this episode revolved around this is the new big game-breaking twist that we have to navigate around, or even the twist that we're used to, right? Shan had an idol and went home with the idol in her pocket, but it seemed like that idol was a shockingly small part of that overall conversation as to why Shan needed to go home. It was almost, well, we understand that Shan is the main character of the season and the biggest threat in the game and the most influential player in the game, and if that wasn't enough for you somehow, oh, by the way, she also has an idol, so have to do this now rather than later. And to me, this episode is almost, on top of everything else that it is, it's a resounding endorsement of just how the basic Survivor formula can create good TV, and you don't need to add all of this, these unnecessary ingredients on top of that. And that's going to be a depressing thing to revisit in an episode or two if some of the rumored twists that are still on the docket for the season do in fact come through. So worth noting that here. And it worries me that the takeaway from the season from a Jeff's brain point of view is this season ended up being well regarded. We had some big characters. He enjoyed doing it. Good reset for the show, getting back on the ground after COVID. Great. But if he thinks that that's down to we turn the game into the monster and twist around every corner and so on, that would be both, I think, disingenuous and kind of it's self-serving. It's a narrative that he might want, and just so fucking inaccurate based on the actual yeah. story that we're told in the TV episodes that, you know, if we come back in for 43 and they have doubled down on the worst parts of the season and the least necessary parts and have not taken anything away regarding, you know, the good job they did with the casting, for example, this season, then that's really going to be sad.
I totally agree with that. I've certainly seen plenty of other people pointing out that, like, what is quite conceivably going to go down as the best or most memorable episode of this season is one that contains essentially zero twists, advantages, idols, things of that nature, and am fully with you that I think Jeff, in the timelines where this is, and I think there are many of these timelines, considered a very good season of Survivor, if not great season of Survivor, would be wholly wrong to attribute virtually any of that to the monster element. I think this season has succeeded despite the monster element. We're 11 eliminations into this. We've had zero idols played. We've had one shot in the dark drawn. The knowledge is power advantage was interesting despite the producer's best efforts to make it far less interesting, and because the players were, like, very aggressively eager to take their own fates into their own hands. Yeah, I very much hope that Jeff and the rest of the high-ranking producers are capable of coming to that same conclusion, but jury certainly still out along those lines. But it absolutely does not seem to be lost on any of the Survivor superfan community, as far as I can tell. So that, at least, is a very promising sign for me. And it actually reminds me a lot of the Sophie elimination in Winners at War, which is one of, frankly, the few episodes that really even stands out in my mind from Winners at War, which is like a crazy thing to consider, given how stoked I was for that season, and how engaged I was with it on a weekly basis. I think the Sophie blindside, where nothing had to do with idols or advantages, and it was just people playing really aggressive Survivor, is going to stand the test of time and is, along with this episode, a really good illustration of, as far as I'm concerned, how good the game can still be and fresh, if you want to use that word, in the modern era, even without the producers feeling compelled to constantly be shaking the snow globe, or at least opening the door for the snow globe to get shaken via magical powers. I think they're dead wrong about how vital that sort of thing is when they keep casting knowledgeable, talented players who care deeply about winning. I think that's pretty much all it takes there. So, Dom, I guess let's note for our scorecards here, Ricard is going to win yet another challenge, this one a balance immunity challenge, and so at least for this week, the Ricard blindside is going to be off, and we're going to do our best to kind of cover our tracks, if we are Danny and Deshaun, to keep that under wraps here. But I absolutely loved it. It was such a small thing, and I'm sure I'm like overstating even Ricard's kind of vibes in this moment, but when he won the challenge, he had this brief second, maybe not even literally 1 second, reaction of like, oh my god, that's it, did I win, before dropping his ball and going to get the necklace from Jeff. And for whatever reason, it reminded me so much of this clip that I'm about to play, and I could not stop laughing. So this is what I was thinking when I saw Ricard won the challenge.
Woo! That game is fun! Oh my god!
A new high score!
What does high score mean? New high score, is that bad? What does that mean? Should I break it?
Shout out Grandma's Boy, still an all-time banger to this day. Dom, so Ricard going to be immune here, and when he gets that necklace, he is going to go back to this alliance that he's been voting with these last couple of weeks and see that Shan seems to have a great deal of influence over the direction that those votes are going to go. And while he does appreciate that she has been giving him the heads up on the fact that the rest of that group is eager to vote him out, whenever that becomes possible, he simultaneously starts doing the math that, like, if I stick with this fivesome that I've been with, it's pretty much just going to come down to when Shan wants to eliminate me. That is what is going to happen. And she's already told me that is something that she has in mind, not necessarily soon, but down the line. And Ricard goes several steps beyond, I think, what the average Survivor player would do in his shoes, in becoming increasingly nervous about Shan, who has proven to him very recently that she still values him highly as an ally in the short term. And he then starts going to work on the prospect of eliminating Shan in this spot. What did you think of this Ricard and Shan dynamic over the course of this episode?
I thought it was fascinating. I've loved their back and forth the whole season. And part of why I liked it so much was the possibility that it could end in this way. And that tantalizing idea that was always going to be out there, but we weren't quite sure exactly who would act first or when or why. That's what kept me on the edge of my seat there. So to see that actually materialize was phenomenal. And when it seemed like that was explicitly on the table, and the two of them are openly talking about each other's respective threat levels, they just completely delivered on that front too. And I thought that that reward challenge setting for it was so fitting in so many ways, where it's like it's this really dark night. You've got the fire there, so it's the perfect backdrop. It feels really intimate. And it feels so intimate also because sitting literally right beside them on the bench, you have the two other players who, in theory, are privy to this conversation. And seeing these two power players really unpack each other's games in full view in public, but because they're seen as such non-entities, it's like, well, they can hear what they want. I mean, who even cares? But when they get into the specifics, Shan opens by noticing that she is very cognizant and cautious of the repeated pattern over and over in Survivor history of whenever you have this alliance making it to the end, usually the man beats a woman, like almost always in that scenario. And when you look at the statistics there, Shan is very right to be concerned. You can completely see why she's worried there. And when you get into these specific cases, usually there's some argument to be made of, well, the male player there was seen as the bigger threat regardless, or they would have lost to any number of these other people, possibly including women from the Outsiders Alliance. Or you can get into the back and forth for each case by case. I do think in this case, Ricard is right to point out that Shan probably would beat him anyway. I think Shan's reputation is so inflated that she would get credit for many of those moves. And also looking at the rest of the cast on this season, you have players like Evie and Liana and so on who are highly aware of those biases themselves and aware that they would have to maybe jump through hoops to avoid getting caught by those. We saw Evie, in fact, you know, when Votre, it seemed like the two of them were getting on pretty famously in the first episode or two, she was saying, look, I'm thinking long term here. I'm thinking day 26, I guess now. And I know that it's going to be an uphill battle if we made the same moves to get the credit I deserve for them. So when you have enough players like that on the season, I don't know if it actually becomes true anymore because they are willing to give each other enough credit. But in the abstract, definitely right for Shan to be concerned. Ricard then responds by saying, you know, I don't know that it's going to be true this season for a few reasons. Those reasons are left unsaid, and it's interesting to speculate on what he is speculating about because we don't know what he knows about the Black Alliance at the core of this larger majority that Shan, of course, is a central part of and which he is not, which not only gives Shan allies that he doesn't have, potentially moves down the line that he's not going to have, it also dramatically increases the urgency of acting sooner rather than later because we're at the final eight for this vote. If we get to seven, that Black Alliance of four, that's majority, and they can just pick off all the outsiders and ride it to the finals if they want to. And historically, this is the exact kind of time where that type of alliance of three people or four people comes together, and this is the last point to interrupt them before they just mow down everything in their path. So famously, Philippines comes to mind as an example, right? Where after the complete craziness of those first few votes after the merge, Scoopin and Lisa find themselves shopping around for which other pair they want to pick up as their final four to take all the way to the end. And Penner and Carter make this potentially million-dollar mistake in not signing up for that initial offer. So then Scoopin and Lisa go to Malcolm and Denise instead, and that is the end game that we end up having. And so I'm sure Ricard is very cognizant of all of that. Don't know if he has the specific worry of the Black Alliance is together or what he thinks the other people in the majority are there. Like, is, you know, Shan and Liana, I think, is a pretty sure bet. You can pencil that in. But does he think that Shan has a side deal with, you know, Erica and Heather, for example? Or I guess Xander is literally the only other person left at that point, but what if there's something going on there, right? So we don't know what he's thinking, but if he has even a suspicion of that, now is the last moment that you can act upon it, especially when you know Shan has an idol, which can just automatically swing anything in her favor too.
Completely, yeah. And if I had to guess, obviously I do not know that this is the case for sure, but if I were in Ricard's shoes, I think a pretty compelling case can be made to the Xanders and Erikas and Heathers of the world, and we do see, at least on the TV episode, that he goes and talks to them before he talks to Deshaun and Danny about the prospect of voting out Shan tonight, where if I'm Ricard, I think he is probably specifically nervous about the Black Alliance getting down to seven people and in any sort of conventional kind of vote, just having a clear majority there. And if we can eliminate Shan here tonight, not only does that get rid of her and her idol and that threat of a potentially at least locked in majority the next time we come here, and a majority that I, Ricard, know have been putting my name out there in recent days, it also, I think, opens the door for him to paint at least a compelling picture to Erica and Heather and Xander of, if we're now down at final seven with three of them, we once again would be probably pretty wise to not let all three make final six, where they can then potentially force a tie or whatever. I feel like Ricard has not quite like forcing lines here that he can spin to Xander, Heather, and Erica, but I think they genuinely would be very receptive to the idea of like, this is something that makes sense for all of us in at least these next couple of votes. And obviously plenty is liable to change, and Ricard himself can change his own mind somewhere along the way there. But if I am in Ricard's shoes, at least on paper, I feel like this is a very compelling kind of boot for tonight and short-term plan going forward. And sitting with, particularly, I would guess, Erica and Heather at the end would be my guess for what he would consider his best case scenario. So if he can paint the Black Alliance as this big short-term threat, prevent them from taking majority at any point going forward, and then furthermore have Xander at least to point to in the end game as someone who could very conceivably be a bigger jury threat than him, I think this could do Ricard a ton of favors in making it through much further than he otherwise would.
He could point to Xander as a jury threat, but I think it's worth asking, A, is that convincing? And B, is it true? Because we're coming off yet another episode where Xander, despite seeming to be this this outsider wild card who's decent in challenges and he has an idol and has proven that he can pull off some big plays in his own right, the idea of voting out Xander just never seems to get any consideration at all. And he now is in the final seven with an idol. And does he still have an extra vote? I've somehow even lost track of that at this point.
I think so.
Which is wild if that's the case. Like he has the most in his armory, I guess, of any player left in the game. No one seems to care. And is this a Dr. Will situation where the target is so big that it's become invisible, or is there just no target to begin with? Because for as much as the internet lost their collective minds over the bluff like rebounding it on Liana at the merge, beyond that it seems like that is like the one thing that Xander's done. And no one seems to be giving him credit in the game for, oh yeah, this guy is, we've got to get him out now. And if we let him get to the end, then God help any of us. Like that second element at least doesn't seem to be there. And the first element doesn't seem to be there either.
And so I think you're probably right about the short term, but I simultaneously think even if it hasn't been the most remarkable run through the game that we've seen, Ricard still could easily paint Xander as someone who, if allowed to sit at Final Tribal Council, could very conceivably make a strong case for himself and probably spin plenty of the inactions as like positives in his favor of, I didn't have to play my idol. I sat on it even though everything was all haywire for like four straight tribal councils. I totally snowed Liana with the knowledge is power. I'm guessing if Xander is at final tribal, he has probably won a necklace or two, or won a fire challenge or both. Maybe whenever the idol expires, he does some big fancy play with it that round. I am very much a believer that Xander is someone, even if it's not true, that he could paint to a Heather or Erica type as someone that has a case that can be made and furthermore is probably just a likable person. I don't think that's a crazy limb to go out on, whereas Ricard can potentially paint himself to Heather and Erica as this big villain who's turned on pretty much everyone that's ever been close to him at that point, if that is the sort of end game that we see play out there.
But do they like Xander? It's the thing I keep coming back to, where Lyanna doesn't. There's a, I don't know if it's a love-hate relationship or just a hate relationship, or I secretly kind of like you, but that manifests as me hating you relationship. Whatever that weird dynamic is, they have their own thing there. But otherwise, you know, Tiffany was pretty harsh in her criticism of Xander in her exit press. Evie didn't have many kind words for him either, I recall, although don't quote me on that. And usually that's what you have to take to the bank, is if you are that outsider and you're able to run it up all the way to the finals, then you get the votes of the people who were outsiders along with you. And then also you get any disgruntled former members of the majority who feel betrayed because they didn't get the final seat that they thought they were entitled to. And I don't know if Xander can rely on either half of that now.
And I definitely don't mean to suggest that you're like wrong about that or that I even disagree. I just mean from the perspective of Ricard in real time on the island, I think Xander is at least a compelling person you can conceivably paint as a pressing threat come end game time. And I don't think that would register as even slightly ridiculous to, in this case, like Heather and Erica, if they are the others who are there with you. But again, Ricard, I think, probably has a couple different directions he could go here. And one of the most interesting confessionals of this entire week to me, and I loved to hear this sort of thing, is from Ricard again, where once the wheels are kind of in motion, Xander and Heather and Erica are on board with the prospect of eliminating Shan, but that's only 4 votes out of 8, and we would love to get a fifth on board with us here. Ricard goes and it seems like directly confronts Deshaun, although not in a confrontational way, but asks Deshaun what's been going on about, hey, I heard you've been putting my name out there before I had the necklace and just wanted to check in to see what that was all about. Ricard knows that that is what happened. And Deshaun straight up just lies to his face. And Ricard has a confessional about Deshaun's kind of line of bullshit here where he says, I don't like and I don't respect that Deshaun is just straight up lying to me, but the best plan for today is working with Deshaun and then he can go home tomorrow. I very much appreciate that school of thought here from Ricard, where even acknowledging Shan is the person who went out of her way to come over and be honest with me, and Deshaun is first, at least potentially, kind of treating me like an idiot and throwing my name out there and clearly wants me eliminated. Completely setting that aside, it is, I mean, even factoring that in, rather, it is more of a priority for me to eliminate Shan here tonight. And whatever becomes of Deshaun becomes of Deshaun. I'll leave those lines of communication open, although I will take everything he ever tells me with a heavy grain of salt. I thought Ricard's ability to compartmentalize here was really outstanding.
And this is a move that I think he can only make because he is immune, not just because if he's vulnerable, then he's the first target. And it's possible this is a still entertaining but less eventful Ricard boot instead. But also, once he is immune, that gives him the cover to go and confront Deshaun and be like, hey, I know you're coming for me, and there's no point really denying it now, because it's not like if you are able to talk me off the ledge, you then get to take a shot at me, because that can't happen until at least the next round at the earliest. So Ricard can just like saunter up to him and be like, okay, here's the deal. I know you were coming for me. I know that because Shan told me, And now that I know this can't possibly rebound on me, why not target the person who I know and you know is the biggest threat in the game, but also is not a sure ally for you because she's leaking all of this privileged information to me, who, and I thought I was her best ally instead.
Right. And so I think from Ricard's perspective, if it's not already clear through what I've said to this point, while fully acknowledging how valuable it is to have someone like Shan in the game who is willing to come and tell you when even the other people that she's super close with are throwing your name out there, and all of her actions, at least most of her actions, if not all of her actions, are directly in line with you being her number one, I don't think that necessarily was the best path for Ricard. And siding with Deshaun and Danny, who have been like explicitly trying to eliminate him, I think makes a ton of sense, because as he identified, if he sticks with the Black Alliance in their like group of five towards the end game, it very much feels like it is just a matter of time before Shan decides she's okay with Ricard leaving, or they just get down to few enough people where even Shan not being on board with it doesn't really matter if we're at final six or final five necessarily. I think Ricard recognized that a major shakeup in the game was paramount for his position going forward. As far as I'm personally concerned, I think he has some very compelling narratives that he can be spinning for these next couple, if not several, boots to buy himself some time. Obviously, he is no slouch in these challenges, and even, again, with it fully, like, clearly in sight that he's giving up potentially an ally who would never lie to him and always loop him in on all of her thoughts, I still think it's worth it to take out Shan here. And I know this is a point of contention for a lot of other people who feel like Ricard is kind of now leaving himself wide open. Where do you specifically land on that? Are you as concerned as a lot of people seem to be about Ricard's decision to take out Shan here?
It's the devil you know versus the devil you don't. And yeah, the uncertainty of the game is wide open now, and that's scary, right? Because I don't know if after I have just engineered this massive move, do I now become the next go-to threat, and I'm just walking down the exit route from Tribal Council right after Shan? But you contrast that against the certainty almost of knowing if my suspicion about the rest of Shan's alliances is correct, I have no more room to play in this game after this exact vote, and possibly not even at this vote. If Shan rises up and uses her idol, or if Danny and Deshaun aren't in on this plan, I need this to go through. And in a weird way, it's almost like once the two of them are on board with splitting between Shan and Lyanna, the absolute necessity of doing it now disappears, because in theory, the two of them can be roped in future to do this at another time. But while you see the opportunity, you have to take it. And I think Ricard is going to be one of those players who would rather make the big move and then suffer the consequences as a result than get picked off without any agency at final six, final five, and think to himself, you know, I had the chance to shake up the season, make great TV in the process, and give myself more room to play, and I didn't take it. And he's going to be, he would kick himself a lot more over that, I reckon, than the other route. I think it's also worth going back to last week, where we had these two tribal councils, and Ricard and Shannon in their own subgroup, they took the shot at Nasir, who it seemed like trusted the two of them fairly implicitly. And if it came down to choosing between Ricard and Shan, I think we don't know which way he would have gone there. But the way we framed that move last week was for Shan, this is almost a statement of how confident she is in the rest of her alliances, that she can afford to lose someone who is a reliable vote for her, as opposed to, you know, a Heather who is definitely against her. But, you know, Nasir has an idol and it seems fairly likable, maybe good in challenges. And so that's a variable that I want to neutralize now while I had this shot. Whereas for Ricard, it's almost the opposite, where if he knows eventually or soon he's taking a shot at Shan, then get the loyal player out of there who won't hear any talk of that, and keep the someone like Heather who's desperate enough that she's going to sign up to whatever the plan is. In retrospect, I wonder if Shan wishes she had kept Nasir for not just for that reason, but also the nature of that twist meant that the impression it gives to the other tribe, and we kind of saw this with Danny's reactions at the second tribal, was the moment that this group was split into and Ricardo and Shan were off on their own, they went rogue and did their own thing, and we were not consulted about it. We lost someone who maybe we trusted. And what does that bode for the future necessarily?
Yeah. Gonna be curious. I haven't gotten to see or hear any kind of like Shan exit press yet because of all the Thanksgiving delays, and also because I'm not generally a person who is remotely interested in exit press. I'm always super paranoid about people not being great at containing sensitive information and rather just avoid it entirely. But in Shan's case, I'm definitely eager to find out what she has to say there. But yeah, I think to just kind of wrap it up, from Ricard's position here, I think you could tell him potentially, if you take out Shan now, you're still very liable to be on the chopping block as soon as this next vote, and that would still be fine, because what he is at least potentially just above all not interested in doing is staying safe for this one next vote and playing down to an end game that is almost surely going to be disastrously bad news for him. I think if I'm Ricard, the decision between short-term, if not like medium-term safety, even if I had never heard anything about Danny and Deshaun like coming for me, and I thought that they would just stay loyal down to Final Five, I'm not interested in that end game. I'll take the mystery box where, sure, I may be literally the next one eliminated, but at least I'm opening the door for a big-time shakeup that could be far more favorable to me in the long run here. So I certainly understand why a lot of people have at the very least questions, if not like active complaints about Ricard choosing to take this route. Like, from a strategic perspective, it seems crazy on the surface.
Well,
but
I mean I don't know how those people can look at an episode where the official story is Ricard was on his way out the door if he didn't win immunity,
right,
and think that preserving the existing order of things is going to go well for me, even leaving aside any does he not know about Shan's other alliances or what have you.
Yeah, but I mean, even in the scenario, I agree with you for sure on that, but even in a scenario where they were totally willing to go with him to Final Five, which it very much seems like they were not, I would still be totally Team Ricard here when it comes to the decision that he ultimately landed on. So what we are all...
Well, one other thing about Shan's approach to all of this is I totally get why she, on a personal level or strategic level, whatever, wants to tell Ricard about the fact that Danny and Deshaun are coming for him. The problem is, though, it opens up this obvious question of, okay, well, thank you for telling me. You literally have a tool in the game that lets you save me. So are we going to negotiate about that at all? Or what's the implication here? Because that's the part of the conversation that either was left unsaid or that we didn't get to see. But it's a pretty necessary one to fill in the blanks as to what's going on here.
I agree with that. It frankly hadn't even crossed my mind to this point because Ricard won the necklace. I think like the scene after we saw Shan loop him in there, or very shortly after we saw Shan loop him in there. But yeah, I would be very curious to know what kind of conversation was had along those lines and what Shan's like true intentions would have been. Do you have a strong lean in either direction? Like, if the writing was on the wall, do you think Shan would go so far as to, in situations where the idol is relevant, essentially turn on Danny, Deshaun, and Liana, who have presumably put votes on Ricard that night, and play her idol for him? I think it's got to be... I would lean no, at least. It certainly doesn't have to be no, but I would pretty strongly lean no.
I would lean no, yeah, because if you think this group of four will sit together, that's 4 out of 7, you write it down to the end, you keep your idol. So even if, let's say, Danny and Deshaun go rogue at the next vote, you do have some kind of counterplay to that, potentially. And yeah, it seems like you can almost even paint Danny and Deshaun as a pair of threats in their own right. Like, you can sell it to an Erica or a Heather, whoever's left over, that we need to break up the two of them. Or if Xander, who I guess is going to be there because he has an idol, which none of you want to flush for some reason, then maybe if he thinks he needs to win his way to the end, then Danny and Deshaun are going to be a bigger obstacle to that for him than Shannon and Liana would be, right? So you can sell him on voting for them instead of you. So I think she's got some options there. And you know that Ricard at some point is going to try and turn the tables on you. And so why give up your way of protecting against that to keeping the person that you know will eventually do that to you versus just the more safe and cautious line?
One other factor that may go into that is if Shan feels good that letting Ricard go and not playing her idol on him would lead down in a lot of timelines to an endgame where she and Liana are kind of an obvious pair and Danny and Deshaun are kind of an obvious pair. I don't think we, the audience, have seen anything, at least anything that comes to mind for me, that could inform us along these lines. But out there on the island, I would start asking myself, in that kind of situation, who's good at fire? Like, knowing if your pair in that hypothetical is going to have an upper hand in the Final Four immunity and Final Four fire making challenge, I think kind of is at the very least a factor worth considering. And furthermore, why I have screamed for years on end, probably very annoyingly, about like the idea of going on Survivor knowing that Final Four has essentially a bailout lifeline where if you have mastered fire with Flint before you get on the show, that can be a $1 million difference maker. It is crazy to me that every super fan has not completely gotten that down to a science, but I don't believe that is the case here. And if I were in any of their shoes, that would be a potentially like strategy altering decision, like point of knowledge for me, is if I know that, for instance, Danny is just lights out with the fire, that could very easily swing me towards not wanting Danny to make it to Final Four. And if I know that I'm Shan and me and Liana are both lights out with the fire, that could easily swing me to happily playing down to that exact same end game.
In their defense, not to incur your wrath here, but I think Tyson has gone on the record as saying that as easy as it is to say, just learn to make fire before you come out here, it is actually a difficult thing to learn. And then also, it is basically impossible to replicate the conditions and the materials and everything with which you have to do that out there, as it is when, you know, you can order some camping kit and you practice in your backyard, but it really is not the same. And to the point where you're almost like misleading yourself into thinking that it's easier than it is, if that's the extent of your practice.
I am happy to grant that it is not going to be exactly the same and maybe wildly different in some cases, but I will not go so far as to say, first of all, that it is a waste of time or anything less than vital to at least have some sort of baseline for. Let alone, give me a break with, it's a hindrance to practice fire ahead of time.
No. It's obviously not what I'm saying.
Wrath incurred, Dominic.
Moving swiftly on then.
Yes. Okay, so what we're ultimately going to get here is a vote split between Shan and Liana, and not a lot of suspense on the revote, although, again, I was floored when I saw these votes come in. I was literally at 8:52 or whatever, half watching my TV, half getting ready to go back into poker, like barely paying attention to what was being said at Tribal Council, because it seemed like such an obvious Erica elimination to me. And then extreme ways dropped when I saw the votes come in, and then Shan gets the big time send off as her name comes up in the revote there, and obviously deservedly so here. I think they very clearly took special care of how they presented this. I think it was really well executed, and Shan obviously totally worthy of this sort of treatment here. Dom, we're going to end up losing unambiguously, as far as I would be concerned, the main character of this season up to this point in a totally shocking fashion here. Again, an episode that I think will stand the test of time for as long as Survivor runs, for people remembering. I'm not trying to compare this to like the JFK assassination, where were you, or 9/11 or whatever, when Shan got voted out. But I think this is not an episode that will soon be forgotten here as we ultimately lose Shan. Enormous character, incredible TV presence, obviously out there playing extremely hard. Dom, are you on the same page as me that, assuming she wants to do it, it is not a matter of if, but when Shan is back on Survivor?
Yeah, and we don't know when they are going to want to have returning players back. I know that Jeff said that that whole idea is going to be on the back burner for a little bit, and that may be the death knell, honestly, for anyone, even in the 30s, hoping to make a return anytime soon. But if and when returning players are on the table, Shan is, I'm going to say, maybe a bigger lock for one of those spots than any player ever has been for a returning player spot.
I think, were Jeff not to draw the line in the sand, I would have said like Rick Devens held that mantle, but I think Shan now holds that chantle. Thank you. I think if she wants to do it, Shan is one of the biggest locks since, I would probably throw like Rupert as an historical comparison for like, it's just going to come down to their desire to go back onto the show. I can't imagine the producers are going to be losing her number anytime soon there.
That first batch of All-Stars contestants was really in a league of their own in that regard. But like, yeah, of course, Hatch is going out there if he wants to, or Colby or Ethan, or, you know, the list goes on and on, right? But in terms of the modern day, I think Shan is in a class of her own. And one reason for that, which one thing that may make returning players more difficult, and especially with the transition from the 30s to the 40s, is we now have explicit diversity targets that casting is hoping to meet now for Survivor and other CBS reality shows. And I don't know if they've said if those would be firmly in place in the same way for a returning player season, but if they are and you have to make that match up, then the kind of the relative value, for lack of a better term, of a Shan over like a Rick Devens or whatever, astronomically higher in terms of making sure you can actually fill out a cast properly.
Well, they will also be pulling from casts that in their original form are going to be far more diverse than pretty much anything we've seen to this point. So that's going to get a lot easier as well.
Yeah, I mean, so if we, let's say we get to like 45, 46, and that's when they decide to start doing it, and they're just drawing from the 40s, at that point, yeah, it's, you're drawing from casts that are drawn up in the same way, and so it's easy to translate that to the next cast. But if also you want to get some of the big names from the 30s in there, a lot of those are like the Rick Devens and the Christian Hubickis and the Dominic Abates and so on. And you can see how the demographics line up there to where like you can easily overflow that column in the ledger based on the old casting philosophy. But for the Shans of the world, like, you are just drawing from the 40s for the most part.
Yeah. In the timeline where we do see Shan again, are you bullish or bearish on how that may go for her?
I would not be too optimistic, I think, because I think the perception of Shan's threat level, even though clearly it was high enough out there for her to have a lot of influence and to be a respected player and to be need to be taken down in this fashion by everyone else teaming up on her, clearly she's good, but the impression you get from watching the episodes is this is Boston Rob. I think Evie actually made that exact comparison. This is the Godmother. And if we don't take her down, then there but for the grace of God, or maybe not the grace of God, but she's going to win the season, basically, and unless something like this derails that. And so I would worry that she's going to have maybe not like Tony Vlachos downside for a second season, because so much of that was based on Tony as this agent of chaos. But it's going to be tough for someone who was such a main character and such a strong performer for the first however many episodes to ever be able to like hide away in the shadows in a second season.
I agree with you. I think she may benefit from the prospect of there probably being several more seasons between now and whenever she eventually comes back. I think like the more time that can pass, the better news that will be for her. But yeah, my concern is the cat is like historically out of the bag as far as Shan goes, and anyone she's playing with on a future season is going to know a ton about how she plays and probably be a lot more skeptical of her than the cast was this time around during the early portion. That being said, she does have a compelling case that can be made, where she was legitimately like very loyal to the people that she chose to be loyal to. The problem is pretty much everyone on that Green Tribe who got voted out pre-merge also thought that Shan was their number one there. She's calling herself the Mafia Pastor. She has her own evil theme music, which, by the way, excellent resolution on that. That was hysterical.
Oh, yeah.
On the reward challenge where Heather asks what she's thinking. That was very good stuff there. But yeah, I too would have some concerns about Shan 2.0, especially if one of her takeaways from how this came undone for her is these last couple votes, she was a lot more willing to let her allies ultimately dictate which direction the vote would go. I saw her on Twitter talking about whatever it was, the Nasir vote and the Tiffany vote, as like, hey, look at me finally listening to my allies, and not in those exact terms, but like, look, I'm not just trying to constantly be a dictator here. I'm slightly nervous that her second time around, she may be more compelled to make sure that every vote goes her way because of what happened once she caved along those lines the first time here. But yeah, very much looking forward, however it ends up going for her, to the prospect of Shan coming back on the show. And I think, actually, we have a couple other things to get to from this episode. But I once again just really want to reiterate that this week in particular will certainly be something that I am mentally returning to a lot, not just this season, but in future seasons. I think this is an episode that is a legitimate kind of game changer as far as how I would consider the general presentation of Survivor seasons and Survivor players going forward, and I am eternally thankful that they have given this to us. So big time shout out for that to the production team. Dom, one other thing that we certainly would be remiss to skip over, but didn't seem like it fit well chronologically as we were talking through just kind of how all of this came crumbling down on Shan. But one major storyline that we saw a lot more of this week and have obviously seen plenty of in weeks past, and we'll see what becomes of this as this endgame starts playing out. But we saw a very in-depth conversation between particularly Shan and Deshaun about just the position that they found themselves in this season, where they went in hoping to work with other black people and not even being sure that that would be an option on the table just based on the entire course of Survivor history, where that was pretty much unavailable to any previous black contestants. And talking about, like, do we want to play our own individual games, or do we want to do this for the culture? And Deshaun in particular had a very compelling confessional, the one where he takes a second to, like, pause and look away from the camera, and there's just, like, silence behind him. I thought one of the standout confessionals of the season to me here. So setting aside just how utterly humiliating it is for CBS and the producers for this 41 seasons in to be the first time that this sort of thing is coming up, I am obviously thrilled that this sort of opportunity is finally on the table for the black contestants and any other non-white contestants on the show, both now and going forward. And also very grateful that they're willing to present this on TV in a, the word I'm saying is routine, but what I mean is, like, consistent, like that they're returning to this sort of thing. It's becoming a theme of the season. It's obviously playing a big role in the way that the game is playing out, and they're not backing down from showing it now that this sort of thing is on the table. But what did you make of this whole doing it for the culture conversation?
I think, well, it's a stretch to say that this is available to everyone, and that's one of the points that gets made as a response to this a lot, is that, so you look at players like Erica or Nasir on the season, for example, they don't get the chance to blend in with what on, you know, most other Survivor seasons would be just the majority of white contestants, but then also they're not included in the alliance, which is explicitly based around racial solidarity and a shared experience. And that's fine for what it is. I don't think that the Black Alliance is claiming to represent everyone kind of beyond their shores and to take everyone else in. But players like that who kind of slip through the cracks in the middle, I don't think that opportunity is open to them in quite the same way. So it's still not like a perfectly even playing field there. And, like, mathematically, it's hard for it to be in that way. But that's just, you know, worth keeping in mind, I think, when we talk about what this change in casting represents. But as it pertains to that exact conversation, it used to be one of the focal points of Survivor back in the day that you would have these moral dilemmas of how you wanted to play the game and how your personal value system from real life would come into this artificial experience with a lot of money on the line. And that quickly disappeared once this mentality took over that, yeah, you do what you can to win. There's no shame in lying or deceiving people on the show, and you play the game. You're here to play hard, and that's what you're meant to do. And anyone who does still explicitly come out with any kind of moral scruples gets raked over the coals by the fan base because they don't understand what they're getting themselves into, which is fair to some extent. And some of the recent examples, like the Ken McNichols of the world or the coaches in his various iterations, there's definitely been tinged with an element of hypocrisy there. But I think that it is a missing ingredient on the show, because the show is designed to be an incredibly emotionally taxing experience, which makes you become fast friends with people and then betray those people. And that is going to weigh on you, or going to weigh on most people to some degree. And yet that's not a conversation that the show and its value system really allows for anymore. Now, though, this is how we almost get to smuggle that back in, because you see players like Deshaun who are drawn between wanting to play for some kind of larger cause and some kind of idea of representation versus the kind of cold-hearted logic of, yeah, Shan's the biggest threat with Nigel, so of course you vote her out. And so now we're actually getting to see people really struggle with that. And you saw Liana as well, who you often find players in those positions who they know what move needs to be made, and they know that they're playing for second if they go with Shan, but are they okay with that? And Liana seems to be, and often those players seem to be, but I think it is more interesting when it's a Liana who makes that decision for that reason versus like a Chelsea Meissner who makes it because she's so madly in love with Kim, and who can blame her, that she's always going to be an enabler in that sense.
Right.
So this is how we accidentally almost get to have the type of conversation that helped make Survivor so compelling in the first place. And it also is a kind of overdue recognition of what a lot of those players are or should be able to work through on most seasons anyway. So yeah, I think it's a welcome development on both ends there.
For sure, yeah. And I had a very similar thought about it feeling a lot like what made many of the older seasons so compelling is like legitimate kind of interpersonal drama rather than just who stands where within the game. And I have, in general, honestly, very few kind things to say about CBS as a network. And I think Survivor in many ways has struggled. It's like way, way behind the pack as far as like the general TV landscape is concerned. But this season, obviously benefiting immensely from including this sort of thing, and obviously including a much more just diverse cast in general, and on a network that 5, 6, maybe even 7 nights a week is mostly devoted to like procedural cop propaganda dramas. this is a very, very welcome change as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, wanted to certainly flag that up there as well. But Dom, do you have anything else from the episode itself before we take a quick look at how the remaining 7 people may stack up going forward?
I don't think so, and I'm worried now that there's some point I was bursting to make an hour or two ago that has completely slipped my mind now, but we can revisit that if it comes down to it. Let's move on for the time being.
I mean, that's me during every single podcast we've ever done, and then as soon as we hang up, I remember something that I wanted to get into, but if anything comes up along the way, feel free to flag it up as whenever your memory is jogged. So let's take a look at the 7 remaining contestants we have here, and how all of this could eventually shake out. As we talked about at the beginning of the show, I have never had less confidence in predicting an endgame through the first 10 episodes in any season we have ever covered than I do at this very moment right now. Let's begin, Dom, with someone we haven't talked about too much to this point. How about Heather? And
no.
her so
absolutely not.
A hard no from you. There's no chance of the fish shop edit. If you know, you know.
I think it's a hard zero for me. I just can't possibly fathom how, like, at least give us something in the first 6 hours of this season to give us an inkling that there's some payoff here.
I agree with the general idea that Heather, for me, is the far and away least likely eventual winner we're going to wind up with here, although you certainly know, and Genius fans out there certainly know, that Fish Shop is one of my favorite episodes of reality TV of all time, and I think I might be rooting harder for that sort of thing than pretty much any other timeline at this point. I think it would be incredible if we got the big reveal with half an hour or whatever left in the finale.
Yeah,
but probably a bit far-fetched even in this era of editing where they've kind of smashed the hourglass on their techniques of years gone by. Maybe I can sell you a bit more on the prospect of maybe Erica being this kind of lion, a lamb turned lion that we may potentially at least start seeing to emerge here. Do you think there's any chance for Erica to be the winner?
It is scarily somewhat plausible. I think I say scarily because I get the sense that a lot of the people who were on the Tiffany bandwagon for no perceptible good reason a few weeks ago are now like joining this new Erica bandwagon en masse. And I don't know if there's anything more to that. As far as I'm aware, the Survivor spoiler community was blindsided by the Tiffany vote out and has never recovered since then. So I don't think there's anything untoward in that sense per se, but I think people are reading a lot into the Erica edit or lack thereof, I'll argue, because again, if after those first few episodes, if Erica were to go on to win, this would be one of the both like smallest edit in terms of overall screen time, and also just like what is there's nothing there. We hear her say, "I'm going to be the lion instead of the lamb," but the reason she's the lamb is because we just never see anything of her. Whereas in reality, we hear all the others talk about how worried they are about Erica. The word sneaky, I think, was used like 15 times in this episode alone. Just people really seem to like that word in this context. And so people out there do seem to be worried about Erica. We never get the sense as to why. It's just announced as a fact. And so the whole lion, not a lamb thing, both doesn't match up with what little we do see about Erica, not even from Erica, and then we don't see anything from Erica in the first place. So I just don't see what the foundation is there for her to make this move. And if in the next episode, in the aftermath of the Shan blindside, Erica gets a lot of credit for it and takes a bigger role in the episode, and now you're her and Heather, maybe Heather as Erica's partner gets more of a focus and we start to see her talking about the end game, maybe then I'll finally come on board a little bit too late. But for now, I'm not seeing it there. And to put it in explicit Edric terms, Edric has had a rough ride over the past few seasons. And this week may be the roughest week for Edric in, you know, like 13 years since the Marcus
ever
in Gabon boot. Yeah. But the one pillar of actual Edric, which has remained consistently predictive over all of that time, basically, is what they call complex tribe theory. So even when their individual winner pick is off the mark, usually complex tribe theory does come through and carry the day. And so this basically says that the tribe that has not more screen time always, but more developed relationships between contestants and more of a consistent story arc and more of a kind of inclusive narrative in terms of this is where we began, this is how we got to where we are now, and this is how we move into the next phase as all of these relationships evolve and unravel. That is a tribe that produces the winner. And so if you go back to, let's say, just struggling to think of a good example here, but like Ko Rong, right? Where even if you were not as keenly honed in on it has to be Michelle, and that's 100% because of X, Y, and Z, it seemed like the beauty tribe, for a tribe which is maybe not that interesting on a per character basis and which is literally never going to tribal, we're getting an awful lot of focus from them. So someone on that tribe, from that basis, is likely to walk away with the win here. Or you go down the line, and even when the winner themselves is kind of a surprise, the tribe that they came from isn't. On that basis, it's tough to use on a three tribe season, because usually the way this works is one tribe is very underdeveloped and you can tell it's not going to come from them. So the Calabaos of the world in Philippines, for instance, where, you know, Tan Dang had a lot of complexity, Matt Singh, of course, had a ton of complexity, would make sense for one of those two tribes to have the winner. You would be kind of surprised when all is said and done if they came from Calabao. So on this season, where does that leave us? Well, it seems like Yasser, they had a ton going on. Uwa, of course, mostly the Ricard and Shan of it all, but they had so much going on. The one tribe that had nothing really is Luvu, the blue team. And so that is a knock to not just Erica, but also Deshaun and Danny. And so that takes out half of the slate of people we have left. So with that in mind, you know, I don't think Erica's edit is really there for what it is. And then also this one pattern that does seem to hold points to it being from any other tribe instead.
Okay, and I generally agree with the logic you're laying out there. The blue team was by far, I would imagine, as far as like percentage of screen time is concerned, the most underedited tribe on this season. I'm just so much more willing after seeing Shan leave this week to open the door for pretty much anything. And furthermore, I just want to be shocked on finale night. And so while Heather may be a bit of a stretch, Erica probably not too far removed from that same kind of idea, but I at least feel like the casual fan knows who Erica is at this point. And there's still time for Erica to get plenty of development in this end game, which I have long maintained is pretty much all you need as editors to turn the casual fans over. And incidentally, if there were a season where a winner could come from the most invisible tribe pre-merge, I think I can at least talk myself into the idea of when it is a tribe that is literally never going to a vote, and furthermore, hour-long episodes that have a bunch of advantages that need to be explained, challenges that need to run, vote dynamics that need to be laid out for the audience, and far more often than not, some sort of ship, wheel, island kind of thing, I can talk myself into potentially the winner still coming from this blue tribe. But yeah, I agree with your general point overall there, and would say that Heather and Erica are probably the two with the most uphill battles for my money as things stand.
And also, if it is going to be Erica with all of this in mind, firstly, what we did get from Luvu in the pre-merge was kind of mostly about Erica, right? A lot of it was Erica is on the outside, and then Erica tries to take a shot at Sydney. Danny and Deshaun aren't buying it because they're in tight with Sydney instead. But then Erica kind of gets the last laugh when, after this perfect storm of events, Sydney ends up going at the merge. So maybe that's something to hang her hat on. And then, as you say, increasingly it does feel like all that matters is the last few hours of actual TV. And so, yeah, if this... this is the penultimate episode coming up on Wednesday, right?
I don't know.
Okay. It might be two more before the finale. But either way, if we come in next week and it's Erica gets credit for this move and is just even a little bit more visible than she has been over the past few weeks, that is enough in my mind to kind of override months of relative invisibility and just like woeful neglect in terms of edit development.
So the date that I, for whatever reason, had in my mind for the finale was December 15th, and I've pulled up my calendar here on my computer and can see that indeed December 15th is a Wednesday. So I may be completely hallucinating that, and I may be dead wrong, but I, at this point, would guess that we have three episodes left.
Okay.
Yeah, just for the record. And again, don't quote me on that. So what do you think about where Liana goes from here? And is she someone you're still considering as a winner candidate because she was on the Yasa team?
There is a case that people used to say this about Sandra in Heroes vs. Villains, that she almost inherited the edit of Boston Rob after he was voted out and then kind of ran with that. I don't really buy that interpretation there, and it is hard to find other examples to point to. Even if you think that might
Natalie
be what's going
and Jeremy,
on.
By the way.
Okay, yes.
And Jeremy, I bring that up because this is something that I brought up several weeks ago, but the good doctor, Amanda Rabinowitz, actually sent me a message about the prospect of Liana inheriting Shan's edit several weeks ago at this point, saying we may be overstating Shan's chances and that Liana could do exactly that. So I am coming hard around on that possibility. Yeah.
That is the one really good example to use as precedent there, for sure. The thing that makes me skeptical still is it feels like so much of what we see from Liana is, oh, look, Liana stepped on another banana peel and made another unforced error here, and oh look, she tried to make a move and it didn't work, or here she is getting blindsided again, or so much of it is overwhelmingly negative in that sense that I can't believe that they wouldn't try to hide some of that at least if she was the winner here. Like why not I get, you have to show the thing at the merge, right? Because it's great TV and also is necessary to tell the story. But other than that, if this is how Liana wins, you could do what the inheritance theory kind of suggests, which is have her lay low for the first portion of the game. And then when Shan is cut down, now Liana picks up that torch. And for this home stretch, she's just she's this more prominent character, and she's painted in a more sympathetic light. And you really start to root for her at the point where that begins to matter. But we're not really getting that.
So my big concerns for both Liana, and I had a similar concern for Ricard pre-merge, is while I do generally agree that the third team, in this case the blue team, is probably far less likely to produce the eventual winner than one of the two tribes that's getting a ton of content in the pre-merge, is there was so much going to Evie on the yellow team and so much going to Shan on the green team when they were the focal points of all of those pre-merge episodes, that I really was knocking down the chances for specifically Liana, Xander, and Ricard. I guess I can lump Xander in here as well, since he was on those tribes, where it just seems to me, and again, as far as I'm concerned, we are at like an all-time low as far as ability to be confident in any sort of like edit reads after this most recent episode. But I really would have thought that if the eventual winner came from either of those teams, it would almost have to be Evie from yellow or Shan from green, because surely they would get more content than an Evie or a Shan who goes out pregame, or excuse me, slightly post-merge, pre-finale, where I, as much as I'm willing to grant that they're obviously trying plenty of new stuff with the edit this season, that still feels like maybe a bridge too far to put an eventual winner on a pretty blatantly lower tier when their tribe is getting all of the exposition in an episode than an Evie or a Shan who is going out early early post-merge.
Mm-hmm.
So that those leave me concerned and make me far more open to the possibility that it could be someone from the blue team here. But yeah, I'm with you in general, I think, on Liana, that I'm probably capping that at this point as a losing finalist. But again, pretty much anything can happen from this point forward as far as I am concerned. Let me ask you about someone I was frankly, I think, too quick to dismiss in the early days, just when I was convincing myself that pretty much everyone on the blue team is drawing dead. We're seeing very little of them, and what we are seeing is like them being sketched out by Erica, and their boat is sinking when they're off trying to fish. It seemed to me like the blue team was more or less doomed as soon as we got to an eventual kind of post-merge situation later on. But now that that is clearly not the case, as far as at least the endgame makeup is concerned, I've come around potentially kind of substantially on the prospects of Danny, who we certainly haven't seen others in the cast like raving about, oh my god, I like Danny so much and really trust him and want to work with him, the same that we have for plenty of other winners along the way. But if you go back and watch, I feel like Danny has actually had kind of a low-key, decent amount of strategic content, and furthermore, I think he's the last person left in the game that we have not heard one thing about anyone wanting to vote Danny out. I feel like I just wrote Danny off very prematurely here, and I'm at least talking myself into the prospect of Danny winning being at least on the table for me.
The other side of that is we just don't hear anyone talking about Danny in any context, really, as an ally, as a shoulder to cry on, as anything. And that is a fairly constant feature among winners, is you get a sense of what the other players in the game think about them, because eventually, you know, they're going to have to win a jury vote of their peers. And so what other people think about them is paramount. And we don't know what people think about Danny. Like, is he that thing that people always say of, well, he's a pro athlete and so he doesn't need the money. However true that may be, given his career history, like, is that actually something that he's going to have to worry about or not? Or do people see him as, oh, well, yeah, he's going to be good in the challenges, but what else does he have going for him? Or is he viewed as a well-rounded player who he and Deshaun are like this power couple who's running the game? We have no idea. We hear nothing about any of that. And so that's what holds me back on Danny's chances. But yeah, I mean, we see some amount from him, and there is that variable that you mentioned before of Danny was quite vocally critical of a lot of these tweets, especially the thing at the merge. And so maybe it's not an explicit punishment for that, but it's also, you're not going to have, like, I still have flashbacks to Michelle talking every episode about, like, the 50-50 coin in Winners Are Born. I thought, well, if this is just the same thing that we saw last time and she embraced, like, this twist element of the game, of course they're going to, like, double down on all of that as hard as possible, right? And so when you can't do that with Danny because you're not going to get a single positive word out of him about these twists, then what else are they meant to do with that?
I think that is a sizable point against Danny, is being presented on the TV episodes while being totally right in reality as the guy who was not down with specifically the hourglass twist right around the merge, I guess literally at the merge there. And I would furthermore say, I don't know if Danny has any kind of intentions of turning on Deshaun down the line, but I would imagine that plenty of the timelines we may see play out where Danny makes it to the finals may be with Deshaun. And at this point, I would have a very difficult time seeing Danny beating specifically Deshaun. I think if those two are both there, Deshaun is going to be in a much, much better situation than Danny is. But I am at least far more open to the prospect of Danny pulling this off one way or another than I had been in pretty much the first couple of months of watching this season. And sidebar on Danny, someone on Twitter, I think it was a very funny account that I followed for many, many, many years at this point that I had no idea even watched Survivor, but at Gourmet Spud is who I think I am crediting this point to, tweeted out one night as Survivor was airing that Danny looks a bit like and sounds quite a bit like Kawhi Leonard. Dom, I don't know if that's a name that means anything to you, but I'm a pretty big NBA fan. And now that I have seen and heard that, that is all I can see and hear when Danny is on the screen. And so now I need to make sure that anyone else out there who's an NBA fan suffers that same fate along with me. Incidentally, Dom, quick, Dom, what does he know? Does he know things? Let's find out. Dom, you have lived for several years at this point in Toronto, Canada. Do you know the name of your local Toronto NBA team?
We are not doing this on air, okay?
For the record, they won the NBA championship while you were living in Toronto a couple of years ago, led by, incidentally, Kawhi Leonard. So,
listen, I as someone who went outside during that time, I am fully aware that the Toronto Raptors have a certain reputation around these parts. Yes.
Impressive. So if for no other reason, by the way, I'm kind of rooting for Danny just so I can title our finale podcast in the timelines where he wins, Boardman Gets Paid, which is a hilarious Kawhi Leonard backstory. So there you go.
The other thing about Danny is, look at what we got from Deshaun this episode, right? Just agonizing over being pulled in this way by the cause and the Black Alliance, and then pulled the other way by just the knowledge that, yeah, we kind of got to get out Shan, and we just don't hear anything about that from Danny. Or what does Danny think about this alliance? What does he think about his alliance with Deshaun? Are they ride or die until the end? Or does Danny plan to turn on Deshaun because he doesn't think he can beat him? We don't know. We don't know any of this stuff. So we're just not getting enough from Danny for any of that to be plausible to me.
I may be doing some serious mental gymnastics just so I can make a bunch of Boardman Gets Paid references over future years there. Let's talk about, though, Deshaun's prospects here, because I think Ricard was probably the biggest winner this week in terms of upping both his position in the game and prospects edit-wise of winning. But I also think Deshaun has been making a pretty compelling case lately. So where are you on Deshaun?
Yeah, I think he has to be near the top now. I don't know how much of that is by default now that Shannon Evie are gone, or if it's his edit is adequately good. I know we said when both of the two of them were still in the mix that if it has to be someone else, you know, our 0.015% outsider, we'll give that to Deshaun. And so now he's gobbled up a lot of that equity that's up for grabs. And yeah, I think he has to be. Would you call him the front runner yourself?
I am very torn, frankly, between Deshaun, Ricard, and Xander. Those three are certainly my top three.
I guess we're going to get to everyone at some point, but you have Xander in the mix as a winner here?
I have him in the mix. I think he would probably be number three at this point, and I've flip-flopped multiple times between Deshaun and Ricard as my number one.
Yeah, I think Deshaun, I think he is a very plausible winner, and you see seeds of that being sown from the outset. So even though he was on Luvu, a lot of the stuff that we saw from Luvu was through the lens of Danny and Deshaun as a unit, right? I don't think we actually saw basically anything that didn't involve them in some way. And then you had that in the opening montage, Deshaun saying that, you know, he's a medical student under the pandemic in 2020. And then also everything that happened over the summer, like he needed a break and this was his break. And what a break, right? If you end up winning $1 million and becoming sole survivor. So yeah, I think you can see how you could stitch all of that together by the end. And yeah, if you finish it strong, then I don't think anyone looking back will be surprised that of the people left, it's Deshaun as opposed to someone else.
So I don't know that I necessarily have Deshaun as my highest pure winner edit factor, winner prospect, factoring in all the various timelines, although he might be. But I do think if I had to pick one combination of finalists that seemed the most likely, I would probably say Deshaun trouncing Danny and Liana in the finals is probably the most likely from where I'm sitting, although I could see Ricard having a combination of various timelines that I don't even know all of the prospects for potentially outweighing that.
Yeah, maybe the actual thing that happens here is Liana understandably just yells at Danny and Deshaun for a bit, and then they kind of get back together and they make up and they realize, hey, we should just stick together regardless, ride this thing to the end. And then, yeah, Deshaun beats Danny and Liana in the finals. I think that's very plausible at this point.
Incidentally, we talked in last week's Edit Zone, a point brought up to me off air by a great friend of the podcast, AJ Van Gilder, about what the Deshaun and Shan dynamic could potentially be leading to. And at that point, we were viewing it from the perspective of Shan being far more likely to be the one eventually sitting at Final Tribal Council, and maybe they kind of butt heads within the game, but Deshaun is the juror who's willing to let bygones be bygones and pitch for Shan that she was the one obviously controlling everything, and even though it didn't go his way, he respected ultimately the game that she played. I now wonder if we could actually see that flip-flopped where it's Shan advocating for Deshaun, although that may be significantly less likely if Liana is there too.
Yeah, we also did get a lot of Evie and Deshaun's cross-tribal dynamic at first, and then once they got to the merge, just outsiders talking to insiders. I wonder if the eventual payoff of that is going to be at the end where, you know, Deshaun is facing the jury and Evie gets a kind of a, not taken to task necessarily, but just follow up on that and get some closure.
Okay. Yeah. We will see. I think, I mean, it obviously goes without saying, but I think this next upcoming week is probably going to heavily influence how my endgame forecast edit wise goes, just because for the last 2.5 months, frankly, I had been pretty narrowly focused on Shen, and that's obviously off the table at this point. So back to the drawing board, which, again, is exactly where I want to be. I don't want to not be at the drawing board, especially that early into a season. So very grateful to come in here as confused as ever at this point into any season we've ever talked about. How are you waiting, I suppose, the Deshaun versus Ricard for number one for you?
I think I would have Deshaun, but it's like by a fairly small margin.
Yeah, I think I'm talking myself into that. I'm doing a lot of talking myself into things, it seems like, this week, which is very atypical for me. I really have a hard time, though. As much as I would love to come in here and give some scalding hot take about one of the two of them being the obvious front runner going forward, because that would make for more interesting podcasting, whether I'm right or wrong, I do think it's tough to differentiate between the two. And I would have Xander as, I would say, my pretty clear number three, below Deshaun and Ricard, but above the other four still left in the game. Dom, do you want to do 10 more minutes on why Xander hasn't done anything and no one necessarily likes him? Or are you, when I initially presented Xander as someone near the top of my list, you seem surprised.
I've done my top five on Xander. Okay. I've got nothing more to add.
Okay. And then Ricard, I feel like we've talked a ton about Ricard. Obviously a massive, massive week for Ricard here, game wise, and establishing himself as a presence on the show. I think it's safe to say at this point, every casual fan knows who Ricard is, which I don't know can necessarily be said about the entire group of people left here. But do you think the average casual fan likes Ricard?
I don't think so, but they understand why he's making the moves he's making and playing Ghost Survivor.
Yeah, and I think there is, again, plenty of time.
Not to cut you off, but frankly, I think that might be how the cast views him too. I don't know if you've been following the amazing text exchanges between Ricard and his mother that he's been posting on Twitter periodically.
I see them every so often, yes.
Yeah, so one of those was, as mothers often do, just asking, you know, about how the cast feels about him. And he's basically like, look, a lot of them don't like me. And I don't know if that's because he's going to be a losing finalist potentially or what, but maybe what comes down is, you know, he wins, but there's a lot of kind of like, there's a lot of bitterness and drama along the way there. And maybe kind of like Tony, he gets raked over the coals at Final Tribal, but then ultimately he and his game are still respected more than whoever the other two people are that he's sitting next to.
Whatever just happened to your microphone definitely came through on air. Was this your cat's doing? Is Ravioli being bad?
Oh, you know it. I mean, he's always being bad, but usually it doesn't manifest in interfering with recording equipment.
All right, it sounds like Ravioli is ready for this podcast to be wrapped up one way or another. So, Dom, anything else that you wanted to get to this week?
No, I'm good. Amazing week of Survivor, and great fun to come in here and talk about it.
Yeah, truly incredible stuff. Again, one final time, so grateful that we are able to come in here. This is the best case scenario as far as I'm concerned, with seven people left, no real idea what's going to happen either this coming week or down the line. This is honestly something I didn't expect at all, obviously, to be in play for us this season, if at any point in this new era of Survivor, but I'm 100% here for it. Huge shout out to the editors of this episode and just of this season. Very, very grateful for their willingness to build Shan up like this, even in a situation where she's going to go out at Final Eight there. So that is going to do it for us here this week. He is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. In the next day or so, going to be wrapping up the Mole 2 coverage over on the Patreon feed and then embarking on something undetermined, but excited for whatever that will ultimately become over there. So patreon.com/DomandColin if you would like to get in the mix there. Plenty of classic all-time great reality seasons that we've covered episode by episode, probably well into 100 plus episodes of bonus content for anyone unfamiliar. So I believe that is going to do it for us here. Great times. Thanks for sticking with us this long. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.